for a moment. We'll see if Commissioner Saltzman's going to be joining us. I'd like him to be here from beginning to end. And on cue. Okay, council will come to order. Mayor Adams is homesick, but has indicated his desire to participate. Is he available by phone, Carla?
Yes, he is.
Hello, Mayor.
Hi.
So I'm going to read this into the record just for the formality. Mayor Adams is not physically present today due to illness. His inability to participate in today's council would jeopardize the public health, a public interest, safety, or welfare. Therefore, unless there's an objection by any member of the council, the mayor will participate in today's hearing by teleconference. Hearing no objection, welcome to the hearing, Mayor.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Now, the mayor usually does these hearings, and as the president of the council, I'm going to pinch hit today, but we're ably assisted by a wonderful attorney who's going to walk us through all the guidelines. So, Lindley, how are you?
I'm fine. So, first thing, we're going to have Carla read it, right?
Yes. Carla, okay. Would you please read the matter before us?
Do a roll call first.
Okay.
Fritz?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Leonard?
Here.
Adams?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Item 47, appeal of Verizon Wireless Leasee against the hearings officer's decision to deny a conditional use and adjustment for a wireless telecommunications facility at Mount Scott Fuel Company, 6904 Southeast Foster Road, LU11125536, CUAD.
Lindley, would you please walk us through our ropes, please?
I will. This is an on-the-record hearing. This means you must limit your testimony to material and issues in the record. You can't bring up anything new. This hearing is to decide only if the hearings officer made the correct decision based on the evidence that was presented to him. If you start to talk about new issues or try to present new evidence today, you may be interrupted and reminded to limit your testimony to the record. For an on-the-record appeal hearing, we begin with a staff report by the Bureau of Development Services staff for approximately 10 minutes. Following the staff report, the council will hear from interested persons in the following order. The appellant goes first and has 10 minutes to present their case. Following the appellant, persons who support the appeal will go next. Each person will have 3 minutes to speak to council. The principal opponent will then have 15 minutes to address the city council and rebut the appellant's presentation. If there is no principal opponent, the council will move directly to testimony from persons who oppose the appeal after supporters of the appeal conclude their testimony. After the principal opponent, the council will hear from persons who oppose the appeal, and each has 3 minutes. Finally, the appellant has 5 minutes to rebut the presentation of the opponents of the appeal. Council may then close the hearing, deliberate, and take a vote on the appeal. If the vote is a tentative vote, the council will set a future date for adoption of findings and a final vote on the appeal. If council takes a final vote today, that will conclude the matter before council. For on-the-record hearings, there are a few guidelines for those who are addressing council. First, again, the evidentiary record is closed. As an on-record hearing, you must limit your remarks to arguments based on the record compiled by the hearings officer. You may refer to evidence that was previously submitted to the hearings officer. You may not submit new evidence today that was not submitted to the hearings officer. If your argument includes new evidence or issues, the council may not consider it and may reject it in their final decision. Objections to new evidence. If you believe a person who addressed council today improperly presented new evidence or presented a legal argument relying on evidence not in the record, you may object to that argument. And finally, under state law, only issues that are raised before the hearings officer may be raised in this appeal to council. If you believe a person has raised issues today that were not raised before the hearings officer, you may object to council's consideration of that issue.
So can I clarify something, because it came up at a recent hearing we had, and
yep.
That is when someone is testifying and either deliberately or inadvertently starts introducing new evidence, are you authorized to jump in at that point and advise us that someone has crossed that line?
I will not always know that because the city attorney is not present at the hearings officers, and so we're not cognizant of everything in the record. But certainly if council is concerned about it or staff raises the issue or another party does, council has two options in front of it. One is, as I've described, they may reject that evidence. Alternatively, as you may recall from the prior hearing where we talked about this, Council may determine that if that evidence is useful, they don't want to reject it. They would simply need to give other parties an opportunity to respond to that evidence.
So my preference as the president of the council for this proceeding is that if staff or council believe we're veering into an area that's clearly outside the record, we would appreciate a prompt on that.
Okay.
There's a few things that we also have to put on the record as decision makers today, so I'll read my script. Do any members of the council wish to declare a conflict of interest in this proceeding? Seeing none. Do any members of the council or have any of the member of the council had ex parte contacts which they wish to declare, or have you gathered information outside of this hearing which you would like to disclose? Commissioner Salter.
Well, I read yesterday an email from a Marcel representing the opponents. I've also been, as the commissioner in charge of the Bureau of Development Services, I've been briefed on today's hearing by staff.
I would also say that, as is our practice, any communications on this matter would have come to my staff, and I have received a briefing, but no one's had direct contact with me, and that is our standard practice. Anyone else?
And I've talked with staff.
All right. So no council members have, with the exception of what Commissioner Saltzman has disclosed, there are no other ex parte contacts to declare.
It'd be appropriate to ask if anybody in chambers wishes to ask any of the commissioners about those ex parte contacts.
Does anyone present in council chambers wish to ask Commissioner Saltzman or any of my colleagues about any of their ex parte contacts? Seeing none, thank you. Do the council members have any other matters that need to be discussed before we begin the hearing? Very good. So the first order of business is the staff report. And so we'll invite up Sylvia Kate to make the presentation. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor and the Council. I'm Sylvia Kate. I'm the assigned planner for this review. Before I get started, I'd like to note for you that this application is subject to both the 120-day clock and the FCC shot clock. Both of these clocks will expire on February 4th unless extended by Verizon Wireless. Also, we have Kurt Kruger with us today representing PBOT and is available to answer any questions you might have regarding the public rights of way. Verizon proposes to construct a wireless telecommunications facility that includes a 45-foot-tall monopole hosting up to a total of 12 antennas with an initial start of 9. The equipment compound would be located at the base of the monopole. This includes electrical equipment cabinets and an emergency generator. Verizon also requests an adjustment to waive the required landscape screening of this facility due to site operations and conditions. The site we see here is zoned general commercial and is part of the Mount Scott Fuel Company, which sells crushed rock and bulk landscaping materials. There's a buffer overlay zone along the south property line, but it has no relevance to the conditional use request. The site is developed with two storefront retail buildings along Foster, surrounded by bulk piles of sand, gravel, bark dust, and decorative rock. Southeast Foster Road is a designated major traffic and major transit street. The proposed location for the wireless facility is indicated in this slide behind an existing commercial building on an abutting lot. This is a site plan that mirrors the aerial photo you just looked at. It shows a proposed 20 by 47 foot lease area behind the commercial building, and a dashed line in this picture shows the location of a 6-foot high concrete wall with a chain link fence that provides visual separation from the adjacent residential areas. This detailed plan shows the equipment cabinet layout, which includes the emergency generator and monopole within the lease area. The wireless facility would be protected from public access by security fencing, and this elevation shows that compound, the monopole, and the security fencing. The zoning code trigger for this review is this existing 45-foot monopole located near 65th and Southeast Foster, which is 1,600 feet west of Verizon's proposed site. The Verizon proposal would otherwise be allowed by right if this existing monopole was more than 2,000 feet away by the code standards. In order to provide a co-location opportunity on this existing pole, it would have to be extended to at least 60 feet in height. However, the ground space for additional cabinets is very limited. I'm telling you these facts because of the very first criterion that staff believes is applicable to this case and is perhaps the most stringent of all the conditional use criteria that apply. This shows the available ground space at the existing monopole, and there simply is not enough room for Verizon's equipment, which requires a 20 by 47 foot area. Verizon also explored placing their facility on a building rooftop near Southeast 63rd and Foster, which already hosts two other wireless facilities. You can see that configuration in this slide. The city has permitted 15 antennas plus equipment on this rooftop. As Verizon explored this site, they discovered that the roof is not structurally sufficient to support any additional antennas, and further, their equipment compound would have to be placed in a parking lot, removing a number of parking spaces that would reduce the number of parking available below the required code minimum. Verizon also investigated the right-of-way placement possibilities, and they determined that the antennas could be hosted at a sufficient height on utility poles along Southeast Foster. However, the large equipment compound will not fit within the right-of-way nor immediately adjacent to it. Here's another shot down Foster showing you the utility pole run. PBOT responded to this application with comments that there is not room in the right-of-way either above or below grade for this equipment. PBOT also noted that sight lines for both drivers and pedestrians would be compromised if this equipment was placed on the site's frontage adjacent to the sidewalk so it could power antennas located in the right-of-way. In the interest of time, the balance of the conditional use criteria and findings are in the staff report that's part of the record for this review. The applicant also requested an adjustment. The code allows required landscape screening for these sorts of facilities to be relocated elsewhere on the site when the facility will already be screened by existing fences and buildings. Verizon requests an adjustment to waive the relocated landscaping. Their application notes that there is no reasonable area on site for the landscaping due to the site conditions and operations on the site. Staff report recommended approval for both requests to the hearings officer. The hearings officer denied the application, but not with findings under any applicable approval criteria. Instead, he wrote findings that there was inadequate evidence in the record for him to determine that the facility operates below 1,000 watts ERP. He concluded that the evidence in the record was not credible, and due to these issues, he made findings that he could not determine which approval criteria apply in this case. The zoning code utilizes the term ERP, or affected radiated power, as a review threshold to distinguish low-powered wireless networks from high-powered broadcast facilities. The decision the hearings officer made raises three issues that staff believe City Council should consider. The first is to consider and determine the intent of 1,000 watts ERP threshold as defined by the zoning code, again, which distinguishes between various radio frequency facilities, and from that point also distinguishes which approval criteria come into play. The council also should consider whether or not to accept a signed and stamped engineering report in the record documenting that the facility does operate below 1,000 watts ERP. The hearings officer rejected this report as not credible on the basis that the engineering report relied on information provided by Verizon's RF engineer, who does not hold a license in the state of Oregon. And finally, given this series of decisions, it would enable council to also determine what approval criteria are applicable to this application, again, based on the effective radiated power of the facility. At the public hearing, there were a number of issues raised before the hearings officer. One category was notification. Hearings officer found that notification was adequate. The neighbors also raised a number of additional concerns about the proposal, which are listed here on this slide. And this slide completes the list of concerns raised by the neighbors to the hearings officer. I'm now going to take you on a quick virtual tour of the site and vicinity. The Mount Scott Fuel Company has been in this location for over 70 years. Inside Mount Scott is a large paved area behind the two main buildings. Dump trucks and front loaders access multiple bins and piles of bulk landscaping materials. This front loader is an example of the large equipment that works at the site. In this slide, it's replenishing some bins that are very nearby the proposed location of Verizon's facility, which would be behind the building wall that we see. This is a view of the site looking northwest along Southeast Foster Road. The site has a chain link fence completely enclosing it, but the chain link is absent site obscuring slats at the corner of Southeast Foster and 70th, which allows open views into the site and the products available.
How much more time would you like?
I have two more slides.
Okay.
The rest of the site has slatted chain link fencing with a 6-foot high concrete wall that blocks the views of the site from all slides. And this view is from the adjacent residential area along the south property line at Southeast 68th Avenue. Finally, I want to show you three photos of the residential area immediately surrounding the site, which consists of a charming mixture of housing styles, some directly abutting the site, such as this home. This is another view of other homes nearby. And this final view is looking at the residential area. The white fence that you see in this photograph beyond the bicyclist is the perimeter fence of Mount Scott Fuel. And that concludes staff's presentation.
Thank you very much. And
one question. And that is, why is the equipment box for this facility so much larger than a standard one?
Well, I believe there are two reasons. First of all, both Verizon and AT&T Wireless were the first entrants into the market. And because of that, they have both of those entities have much larger equipment needs than the younger, if you will, PCS providers like Sprint, Nextel, T-Mobile. part of that is because they own a lot more spectrum. They have a lot more transmitters in their equipment area, and the FCC is now requiring under certain criteria for emergency power through a generator to be provided at certain sites. And I worked with the applicant to try to shrink that pad to see if we could do something about getting it situated in a different location, but there are fire codes and building codes that require separation of electronics from generators, so it ends up being 20 by 47 so it can comply with all the relevant codes.
So I wanted to ask about the issue that the hearings officer raised with respect to the 1,000 watts ERP. So there's a magic line, it would appear, at 1,000 watts ERP, below which certain criteria apply and above which different criteria apply. And if that's true, what's the distinction?
That's exactly right, Commissioner. The code is structured very much that way. The original structure of the code before the 1996 Telecommunications Act set the ERP at 100 watts, which was an FCC standard for the maximum ERP wattage allowed for the cellular class of spectrum. When the Telecommunications Act passed, we saw an explosion, literally, in the marketplace with new technology and new spectrum. With the new spectrum auctions, the FCC set the effective radiated power for the additional classes at 1,000 watts ERP. So we revised the code in 2004 to change that value in the zoning code to 1,000 watts, consistent with what staff at that time believed was consistent with FCC regulations, so it becomes almost an inherent definition. If you're a wireless telecommunications facility, you're automatically going to be at or below 1,000 watts because the FCC controls that standard. The code picked that particular item as the threshold so we could distinguish what facilities should go through criteria that include a number of additional aesthetics and standards versus the larger broadcast facilities for radio and TV, which obviously we see at Healy Heights and on Skyline Ridge. Those towers are usually close to 1,000 feet in height and are very different. They're very different systems than a networked wireless telecommunications facility.
But the hearings officer determined he couldn't conclude whether or not this was at, above, or below 1,000 watts ERP.
Yes.
And is that a practical concern, or is that technically because the person that submitted the documentation that worked for wireless just was not licensed in the state of Oregon as an engineer?
I believe from reading his decision very carefully multiple times, because I really wanted to understand his logic, he felt that, and staff respectfully disagrees with the hearings officer on this point, but he felt that enough issues were raised by the neighbors regarding ERP that he couldn't make a judgment call based on the evidence. I believe in going through all the testimony the neighbors submitted during the open records period, which he also considered and, of course, relied on as he made his decision. That testimony seems to confuse the zoning code's intent and use of ERP as a threshold versus the real-world engineering meaning of effective radiated power, which has a very different definition from the zoning code, and then making the neighbors drew a number of conclusions from some very technical engineering reports that Verizon has to file with the FCC. And the first report was expressed in the FCC format. I sent an incomplete letter requesting that some of the information be re-expressed in terms specific to our zoning code, because staff is not going to try to do the math and the calculations to convert, say, angstroms to milliwatts per centimeter squared. That's not the intent or purpose of the ERP at all. We just simply need it stated in a specific terminology so we can document that it that criterion in the code requiring a provider to document that they are compliant with the FCC.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at is there's some health concern that the feds allow local governments to regulate if the ERP is greater than 1,000 watts, and does that change when it's less than? What is magical about that line?
That line is magical, if you will, from the zoning code's point of view, is simply, as you stated earlier, drawing a bright line. These criteria, these standards apply to you if you're below 1,000 watts ERP, and if you're above, these other standards and criteria apply. It has nothing to do with the emission levels. It's a different calculation.
I don't care about that. I'm more interested in why he hung his hat on not being able to conclude whether or not he could rely upon the engineer's report that it was less than 1,000 ERP. What if he'd concluded that it was greater than 1,000 ERP? What would the upshot of his decision been then?
If he had concluded that and continued forward with reviewing the application, he would have made findings under criterion 33815225D 1 through 3, which specifically address the higher powered broadcast facilities. I frankly believe that if he had gone that extra step, he might have made findings that the application fails because the very first criterion under that group of criteria state that towers have to be clustered together, which is why we have the Healy Heights Plan District with a number of towers hosting high-powered antennas clustered together. Obviously, in a wireless telecommunications network that's designed to cover the city, designed to allow people to be mobile while they're talking or downloading and going from site to site, you can't cluster all those towers together or you've effectively negated the network.
But the staff, you as staff, have obviously concluded different, that it's less than 1,000 ERP. What is it that you're relying on that gives you that assurance that he could not?
I accepted the revised engineering report. It's stamped, it's signed, it has calculations and values in there that, in my experience doing this work for 16 years,
10 that I know of.
Everything looked exactly as I expected. I didn't see any anomalies, anything unusual about that report. My objection with the first report is I simply needed some of his technical information recalculated in milliwatts per centimeter squared, which is the value that we use at BDS in the emissions chart in the code. We use that particular column just to verify.
And so had he concluded that he could rely on the evidence presented that it was less than 1,000 watts ERP, it's your opinion that he would have found that this was a permissible location for the cell phone tower?
I do believe if he accepted that report, he would have made findings under those criteria, the same criteria that staff believes are applicable. I don't want to second guess him in terms of the additional information that came in, but I would suspect that his findings would be different from staff's perhaps, or augment some of staff's findings, but I suspect that he would likely head towards an approval.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I just have one more question. Is it unusual for the hearings officer to just basically say, I don't know, rather than make findings that either are sustained or denied?
This is a unique case in my experience.
I don't think in 20 years I've ever seen one that doesn't go through each of their approval criteria and say whether they were met or not met.
I haven't seen one similar to this.
Thank you.
Self. You're welcome.
One question. So there is a 6-foot high concrete berm, and on top of that is a fence? Or is it total 6 feet?
There's a 6-foot high concrete wall, and then just in front of that is a chain link fence. On the property lines that abut residential, there's site obscuring slats in that fence, and then along a southeast Foster frontage, those slats are gone, so you have open views into the site.
So the fence is not sitting on top of the berm?
It's, no.
Okay.
No.
Thank you very much. Now we'll hear from the appellate. If you could please come forward. Welcome to City Council. We just need your name and who you represent, and you'll have the full 10 minutes. Is that correct, Lindley? Right.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Commissioners and Mayor Adams. I'm Phil Grillo. I'm a land use attorney with Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here on behalf of Verizon Wireless. I just want to begin by saying that I think that this is both a important and, as Commissioner Fritz mentioned, unusual case coming out of the hearings officer. It's important to Verizon, of course, because we have a gap in coverage and capacity in this area that needs to be filled, and that's the reason why the facility is being proposed. It is, of course, also important to the neighborhood, and I want to acknowledge that because they, like many other neighborhoods, don't want additional facilities in their area. But it's also important to the city, I think. And this case is important because, as staff has explained and as we talked about in our material, how you come out on what I'm going to call the threshold issue in this case with regard to ERP is going to determine not only how you process cases, this particular case, but virtually all other wireless cases in the city. So I think it's an important case, and it's one that obviously we want to get right, both for you and for ourselves and for the neighborhood. So before I get into the key issues that I kind of outlined in my hearing memo, I just want to touch on about three real preliminary points and then save the rest of my time for my testimony. First, I just want to quickly thank Sylvia Kate for her efforts in this case. I think, as you well know, her knowledge and kind of specialized experience in this area has been very helpful, I think, to everyone in this case, and her responsiveness and professionalism, I think, need to be acknowledged here. Second, I just want to quickly introduce others who are with me here from our team. From Verizon Wireless, I want to introduce Jody Anderson, Heather Campbell, Scott Carlston, and Jeff Cully. And again, those are all in-house with Verizon. Also with us today is Tom Gorton from the consulting firm of Hatfield & Dawson. He is available to answer kind of technical questions with regard to any of the RF issues that you might have. And then I also want to just mention that the site owner, Mr. Clay Tyler with Mount Scott Fuel, is here as well. Just to let you know who we have with us here today. Finally, I just want to call your attention to several exhibits. I think that you've probably had a chance to look at my January 6th appellant's hearing memo. Attached to that, I think it was a 9-page memo, are several exhibits. The exhibits A1, 2, and 3 are essentially new evidence, and I want to caution you and point out to you that that is new evidence. What that evidence is additional legislative history with regard to the intent behind the 1,000-watt ERP standard. We thought that that would be appropriate to submit legislative history with regard to the intent of council when they adopted that in 2004. You will have to make a determination as to whether or not you're going to accept and reject that evidence, as city attorney pointed out. But I just wanted to call your attention to that so you know it's there.
So you're directing us to look at something we shouldn't be looking at.
Well, I've already submitted it, so it's there, and your choice, and I don't want to speak for city attorney, but your choice is to reject it or accept it. But I wanted to call your attention to it, that it's there.
And Mr. Grillo, am I correct that Exhibit B to that is also new evidence?
Yes. The next one I was going to point out is that's correct. Exhibit B is also new evidence, and it is a two-page letter from Mr. Gordon with Hatfield and Dawson that essentially verifies the expert testimony from our experts in the record. So it is new evidence, and again, you'll need to decide whether to accept or reject that. We wanted to offer that to you so that you knew that it was there, but obviously it's your choice and completely your choice whether to accept it or not.
But you are asking us to accept this new evidence.
I am. I wanted to keep this fairly limited, but I think that certainly the legislative history is important because I think it very much helps you focus on what the intent of the threshold standard is. And then the second piece of evidence in Exhibit B I think is important because to the extent there's a credibility issue about whether or not somebody was or wasn't an engineer, we thought having a third engineer come in and say, this is credible and here is why, would be helpful to you and to essentially move past that issue and deal with the expert testimony as it is. The final thing I just want to mention in terms of these exhibits, there's a third exhibit that I've prepared, old habits die hard, but I prepared a set of draft proposed findings, and I did that in order to kind of help you understand what I believe to be the evidence in the case as it relates to each of the relevant approval criteria. These weren't meant to be findings for you to adopt were you to make a decision, but I was preparing them as a shortcut so that you can see what I think the evidence is and connecting them to the approval criteria. So I did that for your convenience at this stage of the proceedings. So that's all I have in terms of preliminary matter. So I just want to use the rest of my time really to talk about the key issues and then react to any questions you may have. So with regard to the key issues, as I mentioned in my memo and as staff has talked about, really the first set of issues is the threshold issue with regard to whether or not this criteria in 33.815.225C applies, and that's the ERP of 1,000 watts or less with regard to the conditional use standards. Within that threshold issue, there are really two sub-issues, and I talk about them separately in my hearing memo. The first is an interpretive question. About what did council intend when it adopted that standard in 2004? And the second question is the factual question that flows from that, which is, okay, once we know what the council intended, what is there in fact, is this facility in fact 1,000 watts or less ERP? And then, of course, the final question is the broader question, the overall question, which is, are all the substantive approval criteria met? I'm not going to spend a lot of my time here, the short time I have, on that third question, which is why I prepared the substantive findings for you on that. I imagine you'll have some questions, but I want to focus for the next couple of minutes really on the threshold question and try and simplify it for you as much as I can. With regard to the interpretive issue, the issue that I think you really need to focus on, and that the hearings officer unfortunately did not, is what was the intent of council when it adopted the 1,000 watts or less ERP threshold in subsection C? That's the legal question that you have before you. And we think, and I believe that staff agrees, that there is substantial evidence in the record that shows that council's clear intent was to essentially use that threshold as a way to define all wireless facilities, so that all wireless facilities would be reviewed under subsection C. That's how the code is structured. That's what we believe council intended to do. And that's not what the hearings officer was looking at when he rendered his decision. Instead, he focused on a very narrow issue of exactly how do you define and calculate ERP, and in essence lost touch with the broader picture of what was council trying to do when it established that standard. We think if you focus on the legislative intent, that the first issue, the interpretive issue, is actually fairly easy to resolve. And that is that that standard was intended to encompass all wireless facilities, including this one. Now, the second issue has to do with the factual issue about, okay, once we know now that this sub C was supposed to apply to wireless facilities, does this particular wireless facility have an ERP of 1,000 watts or less? We believe the answer to that is yes, and the way you get there is actually fairly easy. The first point to be made is that all of these wireless facilities are regulated by the FCC, and all of these facilities have, as a matter of federal law, a ERP that is 1,000 watts or less. So as a matter of law, all these facilities have to be less than 1,000 watts ERP. So having that kind of situation means that, in general, you don't have to get into this math problem when each case comes in to try and figure out exactly what the ERP wattage is, which is generally how things have happened in the past before. But beyond that, we've also got evidence in the record from experts showing what the ERP was. We think that evidence is credible and that it's consistent with the federal law and the way that standard is implemented at both the federal level and at the state level.
Mr. Grillo, if I could, on that point, and I'm just reading your memo. You said that as a matter of federal law, it has to be below the 1,000 watt in order to get the license. And you say that you further state that we could do a conditional approval conditioned on being below the 1,000 watt ERP threshold. So how would the federal government or the city of Portland monitor compliance with that?
Well,
as a practical matter, how do you determine that it stays within that threshold?
Not being the engineer in the group, I can only surmise and then look to my experts to tell me whether I'm essentially wrong, but I would assume that what you could do in that situation is literally measure the ERP based upon the federal standard and determine based upon the actual build and operation of the facility whether it is in fact operating at 1,000 watts ERP or less. So I assume that you could do that through some physical measurement later on.
But you're telling us, at least in your submission, that as a matter of federal law, your client doesn't get a federal license unless this operates at below 1,000.
That's correct.
ER. So whatever the federal regulatory interest in compliance is, you have that protection.
That's right.
And then you're further stating that your client's prepared to condition approval on remaining below that threshold, and there would be some mechanism to ensure compliance with that.
Well, I'm not saying that we should condition it. I'm just saying that if you don't believe that we have to be under 1,000 because it's a licensing requirement by the federal government, and if you don't believe or you have difficulty, you have concerns about what our experts say, that it will in fact be not only below 1,000 watts but actually quite a bit below 1,000 watts, that you could impose that condition. I'm not recommending or suggesting that you should. I'm just saying that if the hearings officer had any doubt, he could have, and I think under the statute, should have conditioned it. I don't think you need to, nor should you.
Does your client have the right to petition the FCC for, at some point in the future, to exceed that threshold?
Not to my knowledge, unless there is a way to amend the FCC code. I mean, certainly I suppose the FCC could at some point in time change that level, but we're looking at the facts as they are today under this code and this criteria. And again, keep in mind, I just want to point out, this is not an emissions standard. This is really just a review criteria threshold. So
no, I understand, but as Commissioner Leonard, I think, helpfully pointed out earlier in his exchange with Ms. Kate, it triggers a different level of a different criteria for approval. So we'd want to make sure if there was a change in the watt ERP that the city had another bite at the apple if it came to us as one facility and at some point your client sought to upgrade it in some way.
Well, I think if there was going to be a change like that, subsequent review, it seems to me would probably be required. But I hear what you're saying, but I'm just trying to think as a practical matter, do you really want to be ongoing monitoring facilities that as a matter of federal law have to be below that level?
No, but in fairness, because the hearing officer didn't make the finding and you're in this appeal, you're in effect asking us to make a finding, it does seem that there's a different practically, we have a different concern because that's not really our expertise. We're not normally we have a finding by a hearing officer that we're reacting to. And in this case, the hearing officer demurred in making that finding. So you're, in effect, as part of your appeal, asking us to make that finding.
I hear what you're saying. I guess I would simply say that I you know, with all respect to the hearings officer, I'm not sure that he has, you know, any more technical expertise than any of the members of the council do. I think it's really just an issue of whether or not you want to continue to monitor this and other facilities. And I guess what I'd say is, you know, think about this in terms of whether you want to do this with all similarly situated facilities, because there are requirements, for instance, under the Telecommunication Act to treat, in essence, similarly situated services the same. So I don't think you'd want to be having one facility be monitored like that when the issue is really common to all wireless carriers. So I think it's really an issue that may want to consider whether or not that's the best approach to it, or to look at it in terms of if there was some sort of violation or some request to go beyond 1,000 watts, and that would require additional approval, and we certainly would understand that.
But the issue, I think, is a little more subtle than that, because I understand the hearings officer's reasoning. He's not trying to get in and second-guess whether or not one of your antennas on a channel is at 1,000 watts or more or less. He's grappling with whether or not the cumulative total of the 9 to 12 antennas that you project to have, each should be added to another to get to a sum that's greater, that is, this would be the sum of all of those antennas, or whether or not the definition by the FCC only means that you have one channel with one antenna at 1,000 watts or less, you're okay. You're arguing, as I understand it, that we don't want to get into the technical aspect as to what you're generating in terms of wattage there. I agree with you. That's not what he is saying. He's arguing that there's not a clear definition as to whether or not you take the cumulative total of each of the antennas, add them together, and then in this instance you would be, because I think you submitted something that showed each antenna would emit 780 some watts of power. He's arguing if you have 9 antennas, you multiply that by 9, or the neighbors are arguing that, and he's agreeing with the neighbors, and thus he's saying, City Council, you need to decide whether you want to consider this kind of a placement in one part of the code or the other based on the number of various antennas that exist. So I guess I'm more interested in how you address that issue as to why we should consider multiple antennas not cumulatively adding up to more than 1,000 watts than whether or not technically we want to get in and decide how much they're radiating. Was that a clear enough question?
I'll try, and I appreciate the struggle that you have with it, and frankly the struggle that the hearings officer had with it. I mean, I think anyone who doesn't do that for a living would struggle with the issue, and let me try and be as responsive as I can. I want to clarify that I think that the hearings officer did actually decide that there was an ambiguity, as you point out, Commissioner, with regard to do you sum things up or do you look at just one antenna, you know, the highest antenna or the highest channel on antenna. And I think that the hearings officer actually did decide that you don't sum up the power from all of the antenna on the site, that you really just, and he thought that you just looked at one antenna. But then there's an additional level that he went to, which is, okay, now do I distinguish between channel on antenna and antenna itself? And he wasn't comfortable there because I think what he was focused on was merely the definitions and the words in the definition and didn't really understand how that worked. And he lost sight of the intent of the code, because if you're going to sum up the channels on an antenna in a wireless situation, you oftentimes are going to get above 1,000 watts ERP, and that would be inconsistent with the purpose of creating the 1,000 watt ERP standard for wireless facilities. So it also is inconsistent with the way the federal government would calculate ERP for these wireless facilities. So I think that there is plenty of room for confusion here, and I think it's all a good reason to not get lost in the technical details of it, because we know as a matter of federal law that these facilities cannot be more than 1,000 watts ERP, or they won't be licensed, or their license will be revoked if they are more than 1,000 watts ERP. And that's really, it seems to me, the clearest way to proceed. And again, this is not about emissions. This is really just about a threshold of which criteria apply. So we think that that's why this goes under the root of subsection C. And then once you get under subsection C, then you can get to the business of deciding whether all the substantive approval criteria make. So I hope I answered your question without confusing it more.
No, you didn't, and you're right. I mean, he says the hearings officer agrees with PDS staff that the language is properly interpreted to read ERP is based upon one antenna. But he says, he goes on to say that he finds that there is no reference to channel or any definition of any word in PCC, so he's still talking about the cumulative total of radiated wattage,
but only from he's now from talking channel, from, per, by one antenna, as opposed to what
channels.
The opponents were talking about was summing the power from all of the antenna.
So help
from
me
any direction.
So help me understand that, because that's going to help me a lot to understand.
Well, if we look at this, let's just say from plan view, from top down, and you have antennas on the facility, each of which will have multiple channels on them. Some of those antennas are going to be receiver antennas, some are sending antennas.
And as I understand it, we don't count the receiving antennas, just the sender antennas.
Right. And then within that, there are sectors, in essence, directions of how this works. The opponents were arguing that it doesn't matter what direction any of this is pointing. You simply add all of the power from all of the channels in any direction, and that's ERP. And the hearings officer, I think, made it pretty clear correctly that that's not correct, that it's more limited than that. What the hearings officer didn't do is take it to the next step to focus just on the channel, the channel within the antenna itself. So the FCC's regulation with regard to ERP speaks both in terms of antenna, channel, and directional. So in this situation, we believe that the proper way to look at ERP, again, for purposes of determining the maximum allowed output from that facility, is to look at the maximum allowed output from a particular channel, in this case, the highest output of any channel in the facility. That's the best layperson explanation I can give you at this point. So we can certainly get more testimony on that from from the experts that we have here, but that's my best try as a layperson.
Mr. Grillo, why don't you wrap up with your presentation, then we'll move to the supporters of the appeal.
You bet. Really, the only thing that I want to kind of add here, finally, is I want to provide you with a memorandum, a brief legal memorandum in this case. And we've already talked about some of the local and kind of state issues, and I just wanted to provide you with a short legal memo on, in essence, the federal issues under the Telecommunications Act. I purposely did not want to make that a big issue in this case. We're trying to get this resolved based on legislative intent and the normal pieces of how this works under the FCC, but I think it's important for you to understand that I think the hearings officer's decision raises important issues under the Telecommunications Act, and I've tried to brief those here for you, so I'll just submit this to the...
So, Mr. Grillo, is there anything in your memo that argues that somehow the city is preempted in any part of its review process?
Yes. Certainly under the Telecommunications Act, local regulation of RF impacts is preempted to the extent that it complies with federal regulations. So that, in essence, goes in part to this 1,000-watt ERP standard and the emissions side of things that are relevant with regard to the city's local approval criteria. There's also the issues about discrimination of among functionally equivalent service, but I think, Commissioner Fish, your question to me was really, is there anything about preemption? And that's essentially a preemption issue.
If you could turn that over to Carla, she'll distribute it. And one last question, Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you. So is this a new memo? Should I have had this already, or is you just put it in?
It's a memo that I just prepared this morning. It's two pages, and I supplied it to staff and city attorney this morning. So it's new, but it's not evidence. If that's...
Where's the evidence, the new evidence? When did you submit that?
The new evidence was attached to my January 6th appellant's hearing memo, and those are Exhibits A, 1, 2, 3, the legislative history, and Exhibit B, which is the letter from Mr. Gordon with Hatfield and Dawson. So that's where that is.
And you'd like us to consider that. Would you be willing to extend the land use clock in order for us to be able to do that?
Yes, I would.
We'll grapple with that a little later.
But I have one more question.
Okay.
Thank you. And that is regarding the 9 antennas and predicted for 12. Why do you need 9 rather than 1?
I can't tell you, as a land use lawyer in the case, exactly why we need 9 antenna, but I know that it has to do with the coverage and capacity issues on that site. So it's for the technical reasons that they're trying to fill the gap in is why they would do that. And again, it's a lot of this is directional. So you've got different sectors that you're trying to deal with, and within that, you've got individual channels that you're handling in those directions. So we can certainly have that testimony if that's what you're getting at.
If there's somebody on your team, I'd really like to hear that, because also what I'm trying to look at is if the answer is no on this, then would the alternative be 9 separate antennas or 12 separate antennas in different locations?
When you, as a body, if you determine to take new evidence, we can either help you answer that question today. It may not be a bad idea to do that if you want to do that today, because we do have the folks here. And in just sort of the interest of trying to be efficient, it might be helpful to do that, especially if you're going to keep the record open, which you should, to have any rebuttal. I mean, we want you to do, if you're going to open the record, to do it obviously in a fair way so everyone has an opportunity to be heard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hate to keep beating on this, but I need to get it clear in my mind before I get too much further in listening to the testimony. But the hearings officer does... He does say that the applicant's ERP wattage estimates based upon one channel of one antenna are not consistent with his interpretations of PCC 33.815.225. And he goes on to say that facilities operating at 1,000 watts ERP or less means ERP wattage related to one and one only antenna. The hearings officer also found that the phrase did not include any reference to the word channel. So he is really focused on, and you're going to have to help me wade through this, as I assume you are with my colleagues, helping us explain why we shouldn't consider more than one channel and on an antenna as cumulatively adding up to more than 1,000. ERP, and because I haven't got it, haven't got your answer yet clear with what I think I clearly understand his argument is, and I don't have the technical knowledge to be able to nuance between what you're arguing and what he is clearly saying, and have those be consistent, or have you persuade me that what he is saying isn't accurate. So I'm going to need some help, sure, either from you or from somebody on your team.
Let me try it this way. If you simply look at the city's code definition of ERP, it's unclear how you would calculate that. And that's why he was looking at the text and context under the what we would call the PGEV BOLI standard. That's what he was doing. What he failed to do, and the reason that you should reverse the hearings officer on this, is he failed to follow what we call the cardinal rule of statutory interpretation, which is based on a relatively new case from the Oregon Supreme Court, a 2009 case, the Gaines case. And that says that even at this, if you call it the first level of statutory interpretation, you look to legislative intent. And if you were to say that you have to sum up all of the channels into one antenna, and therefore you end up with more than